It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us what you see as your vision as the mission of the ARC.
The mission of the ARC is to assure that people with developmental disabilities become full participating citizens in their community.
And when you think of institutions such as Michigan's last one was the Mount Pleasant Center, closed in 2009. We had the Lapeer State Home for the Feeble-Minded. What did institutions like those want to accomplish when they were first established?
When they were first established in the 1800s in Massachusetts and in Europe, they were intended to be places where people came and got all the therapies and everything you could imagine and then would return to their communities. In Michigan, they never served a purpose beyond warehousing. There were professionals who worked there, but they had caseloads that were impossible. They spent most of their time trying to make sure people got fed. I mean, it wasn't possible. And nor did they, I believe, continue with the idea that they were going to return people to the community. Instead, they just became warehouses, and there being no other services, people actually put their names on waiting lists to get into those places because there was nothing else for people, and parents worried about, after their death, what was going to happen.
So. Big worry for parents.
Yes.
And so for life, for those many thousands of people who lived their lives out in these institutions, was like what?
You know, it separated from typical people, separated from typical lives, separated from family, separated from the experiences the rest of us have had. It was horrific. And when people first came out of those places, you could tell that there was another handicap they had, another disability they had, and that was having been institutionalized. It created additional problems for people because they had to, when they came out, they would do things, for instance, like when they ate, they would hoard their food with arms around their food to protect the food from somebody else going after it. It just was a horrible situation, and it took people some time to undo the things we had done to them. We now know from trauma-informed care that people did have some post-stress syndrome from having been in those places.
Now we're getting past that. As we said, the last one was closed in 2009. And we've seen, I'm sure, a rise in AFCs, adult foster care homes, throughout Michigan, taking the place for many families of those institutions. Has that been a positive development in your view?
Well, I think it's better than the facilities they were in previously.
But
is exactly right. But they became small institutions. Though they might be located in the community, but they weren't of the community. So people might have had more typical experiences and more normal environments. But when you're housed with people you're not related to, a number of them, and you have no choice about where you go or when you get to a place or what you do during the day or what time you go to bed or anything else, that's not typical. Mm-hmm. So they were better, for sure, than where they'd been housed previously. So the movement in our mind, in the ARC mind, is that we ought to be moving away from those kinds of places and into people living in typical kinds of places.
And what would that look like? Because you know that there will be people that need to be supervised, that need help reminding, even whether it's to shower. So how does that work?
You know that we call them supports. Hmm. We find that people with disabilities need supports in order to be on a par with the rest of us, whether that's for their safety, mm-hmm. or it's for helping them with their finances, mm-hmm. or physical assistance, even transferring from bed to a chair, whatever it is, people with disabilities sometimes need assistance or what we would call supports. And they have to be provided no matter where people live. They're not doing it the way we did in institutions or subsequently in group homes and say, you have to come to where we provide the supports. Doesn't make any sense. People can live in typical places and we provide the supports to them where they are.
We go to you.
And we've found for sure that's the way people thrive. Is when they have their own place, they can decide who comes in and out of the door, they can decide who provides them sometimes with very intimate kinds of care. If they mm-hmm. if they need it for their personal hygiene, mm-hmm. they maybe touch very intimately. If they can decide who that is and who does that, that's a real bonus in their lives. It makes everything else sort of acceptable when you can control things like that.
Is that person-centered planning? You talk a lot about
person-centered planning derives from the idea that that's what we should offer people, mm-hmm. and including choices. Choices where it really matters, like who touches you or mm-hmm. or who comes into your house. And so person-centered planning was designed to say, we don't want professionals deciding what happens to people by determining what's wrong with them. When the old methodology was diagnose and then then professionals would assess the person, and of course they'd come up with deficits. And then the goals for the person were based on those deficits. So they worked on things they were bad at, typically. Mm. The rest of us get to do what we're good at and get to move towards a place where we succeed, feel better about ourselves, get self-esteem and all the rest of it. People with disabilities should also be offered a chance to work on getting a life, not just on overcoming the deficits that people perceive they have because of the disability. We can instead provide supports to people to overcome some of those things. Yeah. And to put them on a par with everybody else, and then they can work on things they're good at, do things that they gravitate towards. Turns out, we all do better when we do what we like. So that's one of the benefits of person-centered planning, where you design a plan for the individual, their strengths, and what they want in life.
What does it take, what will it take, to realize this vision of having developmentally disabled people being able to live in their space and having the help come to them and having the support come to them? I know it takes money.
Well, sure it takes money. It doesn't take, we don't think, any more money than we do and that we used in the other places. But what it takes is overcoming the inertia of what we used to do. Mm-hmm. Both convincing professionals, funders.
And family members, I bet.
And parents. I was just going to say, and parents, that we're looking at things differently. We told parents certain things at different points. The system, those of us who were even advocates for the system or on the system, told parents, this is probably what your best bet. Put them on the waiting list, then something, at least there'd be a roof over their heads after something happens to you. We sold them a bad bill of goods. The medical professionals are still telling people, unfortunately, things very similar to that. Mm-hmm. But we have to move away and say instead, we were wrong, the system was wrong, we have a better way of looking at things. And what happens is if we get parents involved in person-centered planning, they begin to see the difference. They begin to say, I never thought of things that way. I never thought of them. When I worked at the local level here in Ann Arbor, I would guess that maybe 20% of my time was spent helping parents rebuild their dreams for their child with a disability, because the system and professionals do everything they can to extinguish any dreams. They try to tell people, if they say, well, maybe they can do this, well, you're not being realistic. Or maybe they could do that. Well, you know, you don't understand how severely impaired your child is. I mean, those kinds of things just devastate a parent, and gradually they quit dreaming for that child. When it's our contention, they should have dreams for every child that they have, including that child with the disabilities, and that people never go very far unless people have higher expectations of them. And I don't mean to criticize people in the past who didn't know any better, but I will say it's tough to make that shift. It's tough to get people to think differently. And we have professionals still stuck in the old methodologies of doing things.
What about a place that comes to mind that I'm familiar with is Angel's Place. Mm-hmm. So they're in apartments. They are living. They're living their own lives with those supports. Is that the kind of vision that you've got?
We would much prefer scattered site apartments so that people are in the natural proportion in the community, rather than lumping them together. The Americans with Disabilities Act, for the first time, spelled out people with disabilities as a protected class. And the thing it said was, segregating people with disabilities is discrimination. And so when I think about places that discriminate people, or rather discriminate against people by segregating them, that's not my model. You know, it's part way there, but it isn't getting to the real model. People living in their own room or space is not the same thing as people sharing an apartment building with people without disabilities, et cetera, or their own home in a neighborhood. And so I'm suspicious whenever something has a name like Angel's Place or Pied Piper School, right away it worries me that we're infantilizing people who are adults and who have, in every way except maybe their intellectual capacity, are adults. And so by saying, using terminology, et cetera, that's, I'm not saying it's not endearing.
No, no, yes.
But it's the opposite of recognizing people as fully competent adults who happen to have a disability.
Do you want to see the AFC homes gone as well?
I do. You know, and I say gone. I'm talking about for people with developmental disabilities. I'm not as qualified, although I think it's probably true as well for people who have a mental illness or people who are aging or whatever. But I'm not as qualified to speak for those groups. I don't work for them. But for people with developmental disabilities, what we need is people have their own places. If you're in an AFC setting or in a foster care setting of some kind, somebody else is in charge of who your staff are. Somebody else is in charge of what you do, in charge of you, actually. And licensing even says you're going to keep track of that person all the time. It just is the wrong. It's so foreign from the way typical people live, and it's so different than saying, "We'll take the supports to you." Because as soon as we say FC, we're saying you have to go where the services are provided or where the supports are going to be.
So in which case, you could be a 60-year-old man. You're being told when you'll have dinner and how many cigarettes an hour you can have.
If any. You may be not even allowed to smoke if you smoke. And I'm not saying that wouldn't be good for the person's health.
No.
I'm just saying that's the wrong way to treat another human being, it seems. That they don't have the rights that you would have if they didn't have a disability.
So I can tell that. You see that there's great progress that has been made.
Tremendous
over the
progress.
Course. What challenges, what are the biggest challenges ahead to make things better and to get things to this vision you have?
Well, the most worrisome thing that's come recently is the federal government sent out rules. They were in process for some 12 years, and they took feedback on them and everything else, and that process finally culminated last year. And they issued rules that said, if we're going to spend federal money, we're going to spend it based on the Americans with Disabilities Act. So we're going to spend it on non-segregated places. We're going to spend it on places where people are become a part of their community and have what you and I would call inclusion, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that in that process, they said to the states, we'll give you 5 years to come into compliance where you're going to use federal money from a certain category, at least the federal money to start with. We need you to come into compliance with this. Michigan has... being a really progressive state, one of the top states in the country in terms of moving people out of institutions and getting people in lives in the community, et cetera. And instead, our state said, well, you know what? We're going to, for some of these people, we're going to let the provider of services judge whether their services meet this test or not. They said, you know, if they don't meet the test, maybe they can go to a different federal source of funding that doesn't have those rules yet. So instead of making sure they get the community and the things they're supposed to get, we're just going to move them to a different source of funding. Mm-hmm. And that gets, to me, that's it borders on irksome, mm-hmm. that somebody would say, we're going to take a state that's done what we've done, and we're now going to not take the next logical step, which is, say, come into total compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act, but instead we're going to skirt around the edges, mm-hmm. and we're going to allow other things to occur, and we're going to take whatever steps we can to make sure we don't have to change some of the facilities that are wrong. I find that a problem. The second thing that worries me is knowing what the adult side looks like now, what we're expecting from adults. I'm not watching education change the same way. I'm watching education continue to do what they've always done, which is segregate people. And the danger in that is not only do you teach the person with a disability they're supposed to be separate and only with other people with disabilities,
you
teach the rest of the world at large.
Yes.
To say, well, they have to be there. So, of course, we're going to segregate them and discriminate against them. We'll do the same thing in employment. We'll do the same thing where they live. So the segregation piece builds in people's minds as their age-appropriate peers learn that they have to be in this classroom or in this building instead of in their building. We're set up the wrong expectation on the part of the public at large. So that's the second worrisome thing, is we're not seeing inclusion as is called for in best practice, as is called for in school improvement, and all those kinds of things lead towards inclusion of all students. And yet we're watching people do what they've always done, which is send them to that school or that classroom.
Mm. And what do you say to teachers that say, I've got this bigger class than I ever had before, and the attention and time that developmentally disabled student, I don't have it.
What happens when you look at how have people done this successfully, and they've done it many places successfully, is they take the additional hands that are available in the special education setting, because typically classes are smaller, typically they have more mm-hmm. paraprofessionals, mm-hmm. et cetera. And it turns out the more adult hands you have in a classroom, the better that classroom is, even if you have a real diversity of learning levels and styles, et cetera. And what we've always said should be that we're going to teach to whatever style that student learns at. So we ought to be identifying what that is for each student, whether they have a disability or not. And if we have more adult hands to assist with that, we ought to be doing better for every child. In fact, we, in one instance where we started this, the parents of children without disabilities came to the superintendent and said, hey, we want my child in a classroom that has that extra set of hands because that they have the extra set of hands as a classroom aide because the person with disabilities in there. We want that classroom. Mm-hmm. So if education would just catch on and start to move in the direction that's called for in research, that's called for everywhere else, I think we do better, but I'm not seeing the change happen very quickly, slowly.
Finally, final thought. What is the most personally satisfying thing you've been able to see happen through your career, Don?
Yeah. Well, across these 45 years, if you don't look back sometimes and say, where were we when, it's pretty tough to keep beating your head against those walls. But you look back and say, look how far we've come, you can feel good about that. I had the experience the other night of having people from a number of states and from a number of places and parts of Michigan and different departments be really kind to me and say nice things to me. And my family heard it. So that was a really fulfilling evening. Maybe the single most satisfying thing that's happened, because I saw there were people there who I knew when they were inside institutions. There were parents of people whose sons and daughters had come out of institutions. There were people who were earning their own living, who had formerly been cared for. It was rewarding in lots of ways that touched me. I would say that's the single nicest thing that's ever, most touching thing that's ever happened to me. On the other hand, there have been smiles along the way from different people at different points that make it all worthwhile.
Don Hoyle is the longtime director of the ARC Michigan and a very, very longtime advocate for the rights of people with disabilities, developmental disabilities in Michigan. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us,
Don. It's a pleasure. I appreciate it. Thank you.